Welcome to The Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. I am Mark Pettis, and I'm with my friend and colleague, John Bagnulo. John, good morning, my friend.
Hey, good morning, Mark. Great to see you.
Great to see you, as always. We are getting deep into the dark winter season, and it seemed another good time to bring up some light research, John. I know we talk a lot about the relationship between light and biology, and by extension, circadian rhythm, and by extension, the extent to which circadian entrainment or synchronization, really being in tune biologically with day-night cycles, is a very strong predictor of longevity, diminished disease risk, et cetera. And I'm always intrigued by new research that's coming out, John, and I thought it would be fun to share a little bit more of that today with our listeners.
Yeah, I think it's perfect. The timing is great. You know, we're entering this next 2-month stretch here where I think most of us, at least in the northern latitudes, are desperate for natural full spectrum light. And you know, I think to many of our listeners, when we start talking about this topic of light, I think that sometimes it's misconstrued. Like, we're talking about, you know, whether it's vitamin D, or we're talking about, you know, just one particular benefit that we would otherwise get from full spectrum light. And I think the topic really runs deep, right? I mean, when you're talking about circadian entrainment, and, you know, as you'll share with us here in a few moments, it's even deeper than that. I mean, some of these tiny proteins that are, you know, intricately involved in light sensing, light mechanisms in the body. Wow, I'm just amazed at how much they affect our biology.
It really is an amazing story. And one of the biologic principles that we're going to be really shining a light on, if you will, John, is this process of photobiomodulation, how light and particular frequencies of light have unique receptors, proteins, and today we're going to be looking at a class of proteins in the eye called opsins. And opsins are these highly conserved, all mammals have them, and these are proteins that are specialized to receive very specific frequencies of light. And what we know from this research, John, is that these very specific frequencies of light, as they activate these light-sensitive proteins, these opsins, lead to a cascade of biochemical effects. And as we look at this, it helps me to remember that light is information. And we are, as biologic organisms, right, where are these complex receivers and transmitters of information? And that information comes to us in many forms, through our food, through our movement, right, through our relationships. But light in particular is loaded with information. And I think it's easy for the average person to completely take for granted of just how deep that relationship goes. And if the quality of the information isn't aligned with one's biology, depending on the time of day, the circumstances, their unique needs, then you get these mismatches that you may have no conscious awareness of, but on a deeper level is completely undermining your metabolic health and ultimately how you age and how you thrive. And so it's a remarkable story. And I'm going to share a few slides here. And I apologize for those that are listening. These slides will be available on our website, thehealthedgepodcast.com. And if you go to our YouTube channel, obviously you can see the video with the graphics. So I apologize to be introducing some graphics for those that are listening, but I'll do my best to be a bit more descriptive in what I am sharing. So These are just to kind of get us oriented here, John. Opsins that we're going to be talking about, these proteins in the eye, they sit in the cell membrane. You and I frequently talk about these bilipid layers around every cell, around our mitochondria. They have embedded within them proteins, right? So these proteins are strategically placed in these bilipid layers. And we know that in the example of opsins, when the information, in this example from light and very specific frequencies of light, activate these proteins. And in this example, I think many people are aware of the specialized cells in the retina, the rods and the cones. The cones are what allow us to see color. The rods are focused more on night vision. But the effect that these frequencies of light have on these proteins is to change their configuration. They will change their shape within the bilipid layer of the cell membrane. And then that leads to these downstream biochemical reactions that are all highly choreographed and synchronized. And ultimately, in this example, the brain would process this signaling as color. And in the back of our brain, right, this occipital area where that color comes into focus, we would end up seeing whatever we were looking at in the color spectrum that we are sensitive to. So this is just a schematic that helps us to appreciate how this system works on a high level. And the opsins, and I want to just acknowledge Dr. Martin Moore Eed, who's a researcher from Harvard that I've brought up before, author of a book last year called The Light Doctor, which is one of my probably top five books of the year last year. And Martin Moore Eed is a remarkable researcher who's been at the vanguard of this science for some time. So this, a lot of this information I've learned from him and following his research. But opsins are a family of proteins that detect light. Their specific purpose is to pick up light. And the example I gave, right, they play a crucial role in vision. They convert light into these biochemical signals that we ultimately appreciate as what we are looking at. But beyond vision, and I think this is where the story gets even more interesting, John, opsins have lots of other functions, from regulating circadian rhythms, controlling pupil size, sensing body temperature, metabolic rate. And these opsins, while we're focusing on the eye, and these examples can be found throughout the body. And I'll look at a few other examples of this. So when light hits that opsin, the protein changes shape, it triggers a cascade of reactions, and that leads to a physiological response. So the quality of that, our ability to access that information at critical times during the day, will really have great influence on our biology.
And Mark, if I can ask a question here, just to make sure that, you know, again, it might help our listeners and help all of us, myself included, better understand this. The analogy I've heard is that when different wavelengths of light hit these tiny proteins, that to your point, they change shape. And the analogy I've heard is it's kind of like sign language, right? You can take your hand and you can make a lot of different shapes, right, that can convey very different messages, in this case to the body. And if you're missing certain wavelengths of natural light, that you can get misconfigurations, right? You get a very different sign, right? And so that's the analogy I've heard. Is that, you know, is that kind of your understanding, the best way you describe it as well?
That's a great analogy, John. I've not heard that, but that fits perfectly. And it is remarkable, right? There's an intelligence to these systems. You know, these proteins, their function is so highly connected to their structure that you can go from being inactive to active by simply, right, you altering the sign that your language is looking to interpret. And that's a beautiful metaphor. Yeah, absolutely. Let me get back to my screen here. And so, you know, we know that they're critical for sight, right? So in the retina, these opsins are really what allow us to absorb light to ultimately form the images that we're seeing in black and white and in color. And the color perception is obviously very important. Humans have evolved to have three types of opsins. You know, we have the blue, the green, the red, which is the sort of the three areas of color emphasis, all of which allows us to sort of craft the color spectrum and the other colors within that visible spectrum. And then, of course, rods are more involved with night vision. And again, we're highly adapted to be able to adapt to dark environments. And of course, as we talk about often, John, our ancient ancestors, after sunset, beyond fires that they created, were in very dark environments. And so much of the post-sunset environment now is lit with non-native lighting in ways that very few generations before us have experienced. And we talk a lot about that in Circadian Disruption. And I would encourage our listeners to go back and look at some of those recordings that we've done.
And the one thing we learn, you know, in terms of nutritional biochemistry is the, you know, the importance of vitamin A for that rhodopsin cycle, right? And we know that, for instance, you know, a vitamin A deficiency, one of the first signs you see is a loss of night vision or decreased night vision ability. And I'm just curious, is there a similar role for, I'm not aware of one, for vitamin A or any other nutrients with the color side of things on opsins?
That's a really good question, John. I don't know the answer to that, but in my research, retinol is a key component to all opsins, all both rods and cones, and retinol is also an important component to opsins in the skin, particularly as it relates to melanin production, independent of vision. And so I think vitamin A, retinol, the active form of vitamin A, is a critical component to photobiomodulation, whether
in
it's
general,
whether
in general, yeah.
whether it's
okay.
through the eye and vision.
Yeah.
And the other, I think, aspect of that would be things like DHA,
zinc.
We know that many essential nutrients like the omega-3s, particularly DHA, docahexaenoic acid, zinc, are all playing an important role in the structure that allows the protein to receive and ultimately
change shape.
Exactly. That change in configuration.
It would make sense with DHA, given, you know, all the if I could use a three-dimensional type model, it has so many different shapes and twists that when you incorporate that into any molecule, it allows it to act as a hinge, basically. And that's what it does for our phospholipid bilayer. So it makes sense that it would do the same thing for these proteins.
Yes. And what's even more fascinating, and I think our understanding of this is so limited, John, but, you know, we're talking about sort of physical science. These are mechanisms that we're able to measure, study. We know that there are many subatomic, right, effects of light. I mean, Einstein got the Nobel Prize in, I think it was like 1905, for the photoelectric effect. And, this is once you get into the quantum realm, you're in a completely different ecosystem of cause and effect. And, we know that, these light sources, this information, in addition to changing protein configuration on sort of a macro level, are probably altering the the quantum vibrational states of many molecules throughout the body. The greatest example of that is probably in the research on water, Gerald Pollack's research showing that the fourth phase of water, where near infrared frequencies of light in that 860 nanometer will change the quantum structure of water, which alters the layering of water on a more macro level. And that tends to create a charge differential, almost a capacitor-like function. Water becomes a capacitor, a storage of energy. It probably is a huge source of information. Water stores information, right? This is Masaru Emoto's research showing how the many crystalline patterns of water molecules change radically in response to the types of stimuli. In his example, audio stimulus, but we know that any electromagnetic stimulus, and light is just a form of electromagnetic energy in as a photon. And so this whole realm we know so little about, but one can only imagine throughout how cells communicate, how proteins communicate. I mean, you know, you're looking at hundreds of billions of biochemical reactions happening in a very, you know, compressed time, all choreographed, all synchronized, for the most part, you know, going, you know, smoothly. I mean, that there has to be a template. There has to be a roadmap that is guiding that choreography. And a lot of that, I believe, we're going to find is happening at that quantum level as that information is stored, it's propagated, it's interpreted, it's disseminated. It's truly a remarkable story. And light is at the, you know, it can be said that I think, you know, light is like the language of the universe. And I think this is a way in which we can begin to understand the beauty and the complexity of that language.
Yeah. Wow. That's well said. It's definitely one of a few final frontiers, right? In terms of that interface between, as you said, quantum physics and human biology. And I think there's so much to it that we can't quite put our hand on, but we all at one time or another have felt the energy, the general feeling of wellness or well-being when we get outside for the first time in the spring, if we live in a place where, you know, that light is generally absent. You know, it's just, it's remarkable. It's remarkable how many different directions this goes.
Yeah, no question. And anyone who's starting to feel the blues this time of year, right, feeling their energy is in the tank, really fine. You know, those are, you know, very important biologic outputs that are manifesting in that way. And a lot of that will be traced to changes in light quality. And that's the body's way of saying, I need something that I'm not getting. I'll just come back to a few more of these slides, John. You know, beyond vision, as we talked about briefly, we know that these light-sensitive proteins are very important for regulating our circadian rhythm. Melanopsin is one that has been discovered in the last maybe 15 to 20 years tops as an opsin that specifically is sensitive to sky blue light frequencies, 480 nanometers. And this is pretty much what is now recognized to turn on our biologic clocks from that morning cortisol surge, that morning adrenaline surge. You'll see a downregulation of that, of course, later in the day. So what you don't want right after sunset is a strong stimulus on these melanopsin proteins in the eye and in the skin, right? It would make sense from an evolutionary biologic perspective that your receptors would be in those most light exposed areas. So ultimately our eye and our skin are really the first line interface of this information that
we're Mark. So if we, if we can carry that out, I mean, I think the last thing you just said there is really powerful, that if you have these sensors in your skin and you're wearing, like, you know, amber glasses to try to block out the white, the blue light at night, you may also be very sensitive to just skin exposure to those, let's just call them big box store lights, or your, you know, your real high, your 4,500, 5,000 type, you know, spectrum lights, right? I mean, you might,
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have so much more to learn, John, about just how powerful these non-visual exposures are. And we have so much more to learn. And it's really important that this be on people's radar, because if you go into a big box store, as many people may do as the holiday seasons approach, it's definitely going to undermine your biology in a way that, you know, you may find yourself buying the 60-inch high-def TV that you otherwise really didn't need. Or, you know, you may find yourself too revved up to go home and relax, you know, which may lead to another glass of wine or not that there's anything wrong with that.
It's a snowball effect.
But these are as undermining sources of environmental information as one can get, especially later in the day. And I think as we learn more about the diverse role that these proteins play, John, it's pretty clear that many aspects of metabolism, and you and I talk about metabolic health all the time as really the holy grail as a predictor of health, longevity, vitality, compressing morbidity, enhancing health span. You know, it's pretty clear that light does play an important role in insulin signaling, insulin sensitivity, altering our immune response. And so when we look at poor metabolic health, when we look at inflammation, when we look at disrupted circadian rhythms, altered sleep quality, you see how all these dots begin to connect. And you also begin to appreciate that food will only bring you so far. Movement will only bring you so far. I mean, critical as those things are, at some point, people will often, and I know you see this a lot, John, as anyone who's a caregiver will see, people will often have dramatic responses to initial changes, maybe in their nutritional, you know, their diet, their exercise routine. Maybe they're doing a bit more stress reduction with meditation or whatever, you know, whatever approach they're using. And then after a while, they start to hit a plateau where they're not seeing ongoing continued improvement, or maybe they're regressing a little bit. And it's very frustrating when you have that momentum and then you start to see it stall. And for me, that's always a clue as to the opportunity to look at non-nutritive, non-exercise, non-meditative strategies. And that's what really starts to bring you into this realm of light, circadian rhythm, and really trying to match the information with the biologic need.
It's a very underappreciated input, as we like to say, right?
Yes, I think so. And again, just as we've talked about, John, these proteins are specialized. They have above top secret clearance to these frequencies of light. They change their structure. That leads to signaling, these cascades of signaling throughout the cell and between cells. These G proteins are often linked to these opsin proteins. So once the opsin is activated, it changes the G protein, which then directs the biologic response. And again, this is so much more than just the story of vision.
Yeah.
And this is a bit geeky, John, but just to kind of make the point of some of the opsins that have been widely researched. And these are opsins that are known to have visual implication. And you see they have very specific peak frequencies that activate them. So we know that in the cones, right, which allow us to see color, the violet blue color is picked up at this frequency of 420 nanometers. This is violet. It helps us see blue, and above that, 534 is a green frequency. And plants, obviously, that's huge for photosynthesis. And we know that the longer red wavelengths, in this example at 560 nanometer, are the opsins that pick up red. Together, the blue, green, red really form the trichromatic basis upon which our color vision is established. And then we know that sort of in between there, this really important for night vision, where the rods have these special receptors for 498 nanometers, very precise in the blue-green zone that is critical for night vision. And these are just a few of the non-visual opsins that, we touched on, John, from these retinal ganglion cells. They're non-visual. They're in the eye. That pick up indigo light, really important for energy homeostasis, metabolism, insulin signaling.
So Mark, could we, based on that, could we make the assumption that if that particular wavelength was missing and it's intricately involved in energy homeostasis or metabolism, that it could, in a way, it could reduce a person's metabolism, it could slow that down? I mean, is that the type of, you know, assumption we could make?
I think that is the assumption to be made, John. And when you look at the current sort of industry standards for artificial light, you will see a lack of certain frequencies. And this indigo is one that you'll see missing. And so I do think that is the public health concern raised. What is the connection between not getting sufficient light in these wavelengths, particularly during the day when we've really evolved to receive them, and the public health epidemics that we see in terms of obesity, insulin resistance, inflammation, and all the chronic complex diseases that come of that? Is there a relationship? And epidemiologically, there's a strong, strong correlation between more time indoors, the advent of LED lighting technology as the non-native source, and now current energy standards that almost put light research and development into a pigeonhole that forces them to focus on just the bright wavelength, something that will produce more brightness with less energy. And that unintentionally omits many of these key peaks of light, as we'll look at here, John.
So the analogy would be these, you know, these really, really bright, intense kind of blue-white spectrum lights. They're like refined, it's like refined carbohydrates, really.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is the perfect analogy. This, you know, I think junk light should be thought of in the same way that we think of junk or ultra processed food. Definitely the same connections. And we know, John, there's a lot of research in various health sciences. Again, beyond just some of the examples that we've been looking at, you know, we know, for example, that in the ultraviolet, right, this is non-visible light. You're only going to get this if you're out during the peak sun season, or if you have an ultraviolet lamp, which is a consideration for some at northern latitudes. But we know this is really important, right, for ultraviolet A light and nitric oxide production, very key for vascular health. Ultraviolet B light, we know, for vitamin D. We know that ultraviolet light is antimicrobial, and many hospitals now will bring in a UV light source to hit a room when it's vacant, particularly if the individual in that room had maybe, say, C. difficile or another resistant bacterial pathogen. This has now become a standard of care for sterilization of an environment. We know that the bluer frequencies, what we call the Billy blankets, if anyone who's had a child who's jaundiced will come home with a Billy blanket. These are about the 450 nanometer range. These frequencies of light activate the light-sensitive proteins in the liver and stimulate the liver to then eliminate bilirubin.
Just think about that for a minute. I mean, that's just a really powerful statement.
Yes.
That you've got wavelengths of light that are affecting substances that the liver produces, right? I mean, that's one of the prime examples of the biology component to light. It's really remarkable.
It's completely remarkable. Yeah. And as a young infant, perhaps with not mature enough systems to enable that, this stimulates that further. And it's remarkable how quickly jaundice will resolve under the frequencies of light.
Natural light.
We've talked a lot about chronoactivity, really our biologic clocks. They are turned on, and the frequency that really is peak is the 480 nanometer. It's the sky blue.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, right? That when you look up in the sky, that frequency of light is probably, it's been filtered after many miles of travel. That color is really what tells every cell in our body that a new day has begun. It's time to turn on systems that we need to be most active during the day. We all have learned about photosynthesis, right? Another remarkable story of a plant. A plant can take energy and turn it into matter, right? Einstein's E equals MC squared was the first sort of genius demonstration that all matter comes from energy. And the amount of energy and even minute amounts of matter is off the chart, as we saw with our thermonuclear weaponry back in World War II. So these plants are taking light frequency in the green range and converting that to, along with water, to carbohydrate. They are taking light and turning it into mass, and what an extraordinary design! And we're just surrounded by it, right? And in our world. And then, as you get to these longer wavelengths, just to touch on this briefly, these red wavelengths are so important, and many of the standard LEDs don't give you much red at all, and none of them give you infrared. With sort of the standard technology, we know this is critical for mitochondrial function, energy production. And we know that photons in the mitochondria, we talk about tunneling. Tunneling is a quantum phenomenon where electrons can literally go through material as if that material wasn't there. It's all sort of vibratory, these high frequency resonance patterns. Mitochondria are, we still have so much more to learn about human biology, but again, at the quantum photobiology level, this is really, I think, a huge issue for all humans, the interaction of red, near infrared light, and mitochondrial health, and what we know and talk about all the time of the many chronic complex diseases that seem to share disrupted mitochondrial function as a driver. Wound healing, collagen production. We talked about nitric oxide that's also stimulated in these red frequencies. You and I have talked about sulfation, the metabolic ability to attach a sulfur group to a protein that renders a very different biologic activity and
you know, water soluble versus fat soluble when
yes,
you do it.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's these things are so profound. And then we've talked about this exclusion zone water, turning water into a capacitor. Just a very fascinating topic that, you know, we think all water is H2O, all water is the same. I think a case could be made that ideally one would want the water in their bodies, what some might call biologic water, to have more of these exclusion zone features where they can readily transfer energy, transfer electrons. They almost become superconductors. And we know that humans, if you looked at a human in terms of the molecules that comprise the human, while 70, maybe 60% of humans might be water by weight, 99% of humans would be water by number of molecules. And so this is really the key to life. And it's anything but an innocuous, simple molecule when you begin to look at these interactions. And this is just a look, John, at sort of the conventional LED today, where the light manufacturer needs to be able to produce a brightness without using too much electricity, right? It's energy efficiency, you know, the what's referred to as watts lumen, and 40 is that upper level. So light manufacturers use a lot of the deeper blue and predominantly green, because these are the brightest frequencies that use the smallest amount of energy. So this produces sufficient brightness. It meets the energy standards, but it leaves out, as you sort of pointed out, John, earlier, these opsins are totally unavailable. In addition to complete unavailability of a good part of the red spectrum and virtually no infrared exposure. So bright, I can function, but not only are you omitting important frequencies for human health, but if you can't turn this blue light down later in the day, you're going to be getting, as we've talked about, a chronostimulatory effect at a time of the day when you should be turning everything down. And that is the basis for the concerns regarding excessive blue light late in the day. And so it's not only what you're not getting, it's what you're getting too much of late in the day. This might be fine during daylight hours, even though you're still omitting these major sources of light information.
But at least it wouldn't be stimulatory, right? So you're missing out on certain, in this case, nutrients, let's say, for the body in the way of light. Yes. But at least you're not having a, you know, three espressos at midnight. Right?
That is a perfect way to describe it, John. I love that translation. And we know that this infrared, and I'm almost done here. I know there's a lot of content here.
Well, this one, this one is phenomenal here when you talk about infrared light and penetration.
Yeah. So none of the typical artificial light sources out there have these frequencies of light. And you know, as we've talked about, approximately 40% of light quality that reaches the surface of this planet is infrared.
Yeah.
It's the predominant frequency of light. Yeah. Now there has to be some significance to that. And we certainly know whether one is using a red near infrared light source as I use, whether it's a handheld light source that I'll hold to a particular muscle or joint that's sore, or whether it's an infrared sauna. There are many red near infrared light sources, some of which are very inexpensive, that are just really nice to sit under. These are thermal sources. They produce heat, and they're longer wavelengths that have a deeper penetration. Some researchers say that near infrared light doesn't penetrate nearly as deep as what others believe. But again, I think one has to distinguish the sort of the physical properties, from the quantum properties, because quantum really starts to fall outside the typical ways in which we could measure penetration. These patterns of wavelength and oscillation and alterations in water structure can affect tissues, I believe, in ways probably throughout the body that might otherwise be hard to measure in terms of depth. And so I think we still have a lot to learn about that. But the point is that these are windows of penetration that allow that information, that light nourishment, I love that, John, to penetrate. And then very lastly,
Mark, I've heard that, and again, I'm not sure if it's agreed upon widely, but I've heard that the infrared light can penetrate, 2 centimeters, 2 centimeters deep beyond the surface of our skin.
Yeah.
That's an enormous volume of cells.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at quantum effects, you know that these cells can propagate in a non-material way information literally at the speed of light. So, we don't know what we don't know, but I think there's enough mechanistically for us to say that, you can probably demonstrate near infrared frequencies a couple centimeters deep, but might the effects go far beyond that? And I believe they do. And again, I want to emphasize that, you and I have no conflicts of interest here in terms of investments, paybacks from any of these companies. I offer this because I do think they're at the vanguard of attempting to develop light technology that allows one to have the frequencies they need during the day and to turn down the frequencies they don't need at night, all in one light source. And this, again, to my knowledge, is first to market.
And the name of this company is OIO?
OIO. If you Google that, you'll... Yeah. And Dr. Moore Ede has been a scientific officer. He's really helped promote a lot of the research and development of this technology. They've got reading lights. They've got lights that you could put in any fixture, and they can be programmed. So at 2 p.m, the light source will look different than it might look at 6 p.m, which would be different than it would look like at 10 p.m. And all of that in the same bulb. And they give you a cool little handheld spectrometer, which is pretty good. In the day mode, you're getting that violet, right? You're getting the opsins, all of those frequencies, very evenly distributed, just as you would get from sunshine. There's no ultraviolet here, but as you get into later in the day, you'll see the blue light fraction is completely omitted. And then later in the day, not only is the blue omitted, but the lumens, the brightness is way down. Ideally, after sunset, you want to try to keep your environment to less than 100 lumens, which is, pretty dark. So the quality of darkness becomes just as important as the quality of light at that time of day. So that was a lot of geek speak, John, but
that's awesome, though.
Really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. I think it's, again, I love the point you made. Everybody, and myself included, really dives deep into, how we move, how we train our bodies, what we eat. But I don't, I certainly don't spend as much time, you know, looking at the quality of light and the different environments I'm in. And I have a vitamin D lamp, you know, but I this is something that I find to be really fascinating. And I think because it does still entail some mystery, there's so much we don't know about that quantum physics component to it. So thanks a lot. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome, John. And I do think for anyone who's maybe made some great changes in their lifestyle and found that they're hitting a wall, this is definitely an area of opportunity worth looking at. And of course, we're reminded, John, that no matter the time of year, being outside under sunlight, whether it's a sunny day or not, is still the gold standard. You certainly won't get much of that ultraviolet light. But there's no light bulb that can mimic our solar system power source. Beautiful. And then of course, you know, during those peak sun months, it's really the morning, earlier morning and the later afternoon, early evening, where you don't need a lot of exposure to get the benefit of those frequencies of light. And then if one is just a bit more mindful after dark of the light quality in the rooms that they're spending more time in particular, the elimination of blue light will go a long way to, without a huge expense and without a lot of complexity. My light regimen, it would be certainly this time of year, full spectrum light in the morning. And I think I may have shared the light source that I use for that. It's called Sol Ray. And again, I have no financial ties to that company, but it has all that you would want from like rising sunlight. It doesn't have the ultraviolet, but it does have the near infrared, red, and the full color spectrum. It's a beautiful early morning, and it has over 10,000 lux. So that would be the indoor equivalent of going outside otherwise and getting that sunlight. And then, you know, later in the day, you know, I'll just make sure that I'm in a blue lit free environment. I might use blue blocker glasses if I can't influence that as much. You know, otherwise it's get outdoors, right? And you know, take those sunglasses off, and even on a chilly day, you know, 5 minutes of exposure, in addition to the light information, the nourishment, you know, you get a little bit of that cold, right, thermogenesis, and you know, that can
tweak multifaceted multifaceted approach to changing your metabolism.
So our ancient ancestors didn't need to know any of this photobiology
it was built into the day,
and that was but this can help people develop a strategy that might be you know personalized to the environments that they're in, and then just keep track of what you might notice, your sleep quality. A lot of people have Aura rings and, you know, sleep apps. And so whatever tool you use, a continuous glucose monitor for your, you know, just notice changes. They might be subtle, but they might also be pretty significant. And over time, these will pay huge dividends.
Awesome stuff, buddy.
John, great to connect as always.
Same
and,
here.
And hopefully we can see each other next week.
That'd be great.
I think it's the day before Thanksgiving.
You're
around,
perfect.
You know, we'll
absolutely
maybe. I don't know, John. You're such a you have such a great knowledge of the culinary aspects. Maybe we could talk a little bit about.
Let's talk about a traditional Thanksgiving. Yeah, a traditional Thanksgiving menu. A menu, and then I will try to give our listeners some very specific details about each of their traditional recipes that they can tweak to elicit improved health. How's that?
There you go. That sounds perfect. And of course, that will cover the entire holiday season, where we're all challenged to choose more wisely.
A lot of overlap there for sure.
Great, John. Well, good to see you, my friend. You stay well.
You too. Always great, Mark. Thanks.